Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. ICE continues to conduct deportation operations in the Chicago area, but there is pushback. We'll talk with a group of volunteers leading the resistance. Also, we'll visit with a Republican lawmaker from Illinois about some of the key issues facing the country, and we head to an art gallery using quilts to remember the incarcerated. A lot of people try to buy food grown locally, but it often costs more than food produced elsewhere and shipped longer distances. We'll look at why. The trucking industry is in a recession. An industry official will discuss the pressure on companies. There's a growing trend in divorces. Older people are splitting up. An attorney explains some reasons why. And we preview a documentary on pie. That and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The U.S. Homeland Security Department says it has arrested more people in the Chicago area as part of a Trump administration deportation blitz. To counter fear and anxiety among immigrants, advocates have organized rapid response networks. The idea is to track down immigration agents, then monitor and protest their activity. A West Suburban group coordinates a rapid response network called the People's Patrol. Chip Mitchell spent a day on patrol with the group's leader.
It's mid-morning in Wheaton, 25 miles west of downtown Chicago. Cristobal Cavazos opens his car's hatch and packs in bullhorns, five-gallon buckets, and drumsticks to pound on him. He invites me to climb in, and right away he gets a call. It's a People's Patrol volunteer. She's at an industrial park in Bensonville, a half hour away. There's a lot of manufacturing and food processing there because it's near O'Hare, the airport. This volunteer tells Cristobal there are also a lot of feds today, maybe from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the agency known as ICE.
There's been a hotbed of ICE activity there since Trump came in. And we've actually seen ICE go into a factory about a month and a half ago looking for someone, and they freaked out the whole factory, and they took some people there. So we're headed there, and it's just really sad the way the United States crucifies their workers, particularly in this case, their essential workers that are in these factories giving us food.
Cristobal heads the Casa DuPage Workers Center, a nonprofit focused on immigrant rights. It runs the People's Patrol, an effort to locate ICE activity, record it, document any abuses, and voice community opposition right on the spot.
We have 180 people, all volunteers, trainings every other Friday.
As they go about their daily lives, they all keep an eye out for ICE activity. The ICE officers drive unmarked vehicles, but People's Patrol volunteers will sometimes tail them. If the agents stop anyone or converge on a house or workplace, volunteers get the word out through a Facebook page and text groups.
We'll send people to go check it out. We want to go in and show the community, hey, we got your back. We're in the midst of a historic fight back right now against ICE.
Cristobal clenches his fist. I make sure the other hand stays on the wheel.
We're not going to leave any space to ICE. The People's Patrol is there to fill these spaces of terror and fear with solidarity and strength.
We get to Bensonville, and it turns out to be just a press conference about some illegal imports, no immigration sweep. Now, though, Cristobal is getting word about ICE arrests out in Elgin.
So we're going to head over. We're going to grab our car.
We get back on an expressway. I'm getting a sense of the mileage Cristobal racks up each day to show his community's opposition to President Trump's deportation blitz. I ask how he got into this work. He talks about his parents. His mom came from South Texas. His dad, Northern Mexico, migrant farm workers.
They would drive all over. They would go to Nebraska. They would go to Indiana. They would go to Michigan for the apples, potato picking in Idaho, and they started to pick cotton. Keep in mind, these were Mexican workers traveling in the South during Jim Crow and Juan Crow, being asked to sit in the back of restaurants. And my father as well, you know, he would tell us stories about when they would go to Mexico, they would come back and they would spray them with some kind of a chemical spray to supposedly get all the germs off of Mexican workers.
Sprayed down with DDT, a pesticide later banned for killing too much wildlife. Eventually, Cristobal's parents heard about jobs in the Chicago area. They settled in DuPage County. Cristobal was born in Winfield. Throughout his childhood, he heard what his parents had gone through, but also about freedom fighters like farm worker organizer Cesar Chavez and Mexican revolutionary Emiliano Zapata.
Zapata once said, "I would rather spend one day standing up than 1,000 years on my knees."
So Cristobal gets in his car day after day to stand up to Trump's immigration enforcement.
Ya estamos en dos minutos.
We finally reach Elgin. Some People's Patrol volunteers there tell Cristobal the day's immigration arrests seem to be over with. But now there's a call about a Homeland Security SUV outside a hotel 20 minutes away.
Parked at the Marriott in Bloomingdale. So that's where we were headed over there.
When we pull up, the SUV is still there. So are some People's Patrol volunteers. I follow them to the front desk.
This is my general manager.
Hey, how y'all doing?
The hotel manager tells Cristobal that Homeland Security officers are frequent guests there. He tells her that's wrong.
The fact that they're staying here, using your premises, you know, to launch their war of terror on the immigrant communities we see, you know, that goes against our values. I would invite you to just tell them to leave, you know.
Cristobal's request to the hotel manager that she kick out the Homeland Security officers, it seemed like a long shot, so he starts working his phone to get more of his people there. By sundown, 24 protesters are in front of the hotel with a petition to kick the officers out. A few days later, I find Cristobal at a different protest. I ask him to sit down for a minute.
So, Cristobal, you've been fighting for immigrant workers for more than 2 decades. Now there's a backlash and this crackdown on undocumented workers. How do you feel?
You know, we had a protest a couple weeks ago, and we had one guy literally come up and spewing racial epithets and screaming at us.
Then an immigration officer in West Suburban Franklin Park fatally shot a Mexican man during a traffic stop.
You feel this almost like this emptiness. And you look at your community and people that you love are afraid. It's a dark night of the soul. People on social media, they don't like what we're doing and they think that we're too out there. We're putting people in danger by being community organizers.
You're hearing this from some immigrants.
Yeah. When you feel the government attacking you, you just feel that you're somehow not an essential, valuable part of the community, that you should be gone because of the color of your skin or the fact that you were not born. In the United States, there's people that don't have courage right now.
Cristobal admits sometimes he doesn't have courage. He sometimes questions his role in the immigrant movement.
Here we have Mexican-American born in Winfield. You know, most of our base is, you know, from Mexico, you know. I have relatives that don't support what I do, conservative relatives that are evangelical Christians that just think, you know, that Trump is somehow part of the Armageddon and, you know, the end of the world.
That it's all inevitable. So I ask him how he keeps going.
Every morning I give thanks to God. I give thanks for my family. I give thanks for my organization, Casa DuPage. I give thanks for the beautiful allies. You know, the past few months, more and more people have been coming out of the shadows to say, how can we help?
Well, how can they help?
Sometimes the only thing we have is resistance. We don't know where this is going to end. But you have faith in justice. You have faith in principle. You have faith.
Cristobal Cavazos says his faith will guide him when he's back out on patrol tomorrow and the day after. Chip Mitchell, WBEZ News.
Meanwhile, a top U.S. Border Patrol official says immigration agents are arresting people based on how they look. Gregory Bovino was patrolling the downtown Chicago area with dozens of agents in military-style fatigues when he spoke to a WBEZ reporter about the methods the feds are using in their push to ramp up deportations. Over the past decade, there's been more momentum behind the land back movement, where Native tribes try to regain ancestral lands. In one of the latest cases, the state of Illinois returned land to the Prairie Band Potawatomi that was illegally sold nearly 200 years ago. Peter Medlin reports on the growing land back movement in the Midwest and the different ways that tribes are actually getting their land returned.
Raphael Wawesik drives through Chief Shabanoff Forest Preserve in northern Illinois. He's a member of the Prairie Band Potawatomi's Tribal Council and a direct descendant of the chief.
If this is accurate, that this was the site where his cabin was, then within a few hundred yards, You know, I've got some family members that are buried out in these woods here.
The Prairie Band was removed from Illinois in the 19th century. The reservation's now in Kansas. But in 2024, the federal government put land the tribe purchased in trust, making the Prairie Band Illinois' first federally recognized tribal nation. And this year, they got even more land back when Illinois passed a law transferring ownership of the neighboring Shabbinaw Lake State Park to the tribe.
You know, my family have been coming up here for almost the two centuries since we've been forced out. And to see that happen in my lifetime is something that I thought I would never experience.
Recently, other Midwest tribes have successfully gotten land back through various means. Just last year, Minnesota returned a state park to the Dakota tribe, and Congress passed a law returning land to the Winnebago in Iowa. Kevin Washburn served as Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs in the Obama administration and is a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation. And he says that while the movement's gotten more public attention lately, it's not new.
Tribes have been wanting their land back probably since before the ink was dried on the original treaties where they ceded that land.
And tribes lost even more land after the Dawes Act in 1887, which broke commonly owned reservations into individual parcels. In the allotment era, about 65% of reservation land fell out of native hands. Today, tribes own around 60 million acres across the U.S., which is about the size of the state of Oregon. And while some have gotten land returned by states or the federal government, Washburn says that is not the norm.
The most common way that tribes get land back is they go out and buy the land.
Many tribes have made buying land back a priority. Nicole Rummel is with the Oneida Nation's Land Management Department. They're a tribe just outside of Green Bay, Wisconsin, and she describes how they started the process more than 40 years ago.
In 82, that's when the tribe approved every carton of cigarettes being sold, 30 cents of that went to land acquisition. So that's really what started money going back into being able to buy land.
They now operate a casino as well, and they've been able to purchase nearly half of the reservation land they lost. But tribes face challenges when purchasing land. In 2023, when the federal government put 500 acres of land the Oneida Nation owned into trust, a Wisconsin village sued in part because of lost tax revenue. The case is in federal court. And sometimes people take advantage of how important it is for tribes to restore their homelands. Matthew Wiesaw is the tribal chair of the Pokagon Band Potawatomi, which has land in Michigan and Indiana.
When people find out it's the Pokagon Band that's looking to purchase the land, the price gets really jacked up. So we have to do a lot of stuff under the cover of different entities.
For me, I didn't need the piece of paper to really drive that home. That's something that has been instilled in me since I was a young boy, that this is part of our home as well.
Wiesaw says they don't buy land just to buy land. They focus on reclaiming sacred places like old villages, historic sites, and burial grounds. Back in Illinois, Raphael Wawusik looks out across Shabbinaw Lake, which was once part of a Prairie Band village. And even though the tribe was forced off this land so long ago, he says he still feels a strong connection to this place. His family always has. And as the land back movement picks up steam, he hopes more tribes will be able to return to their ancestral homes. I'm Peter Medlin.
At a Chicago art gallery, a group of community members came together to make a quilt. But it's not your average bedspread. Every square is a portrait of someone who is or used to be locked up inside a prison. Lauren Frost has that story.
At a big wood crafting table, Darnisha Lanier is holding a stack of photographs of her son, Sharon.
I mean, look at these pictures. All he does, he smiles. He's always smiling, a happy-go-lucky person. And he's still that way. You know, even though he's been in prison for 28 years, he hasn't lost that.
Darnisha's son is serving two life sentences. He's been incarcerated for more than half his life.
He has a master's degree, he has a barbering license, and he's teaching now. So he's doing a lot of things.
Soon, portraits of Sharon and dozens of other incarcerated loved ones will be sewn together into a collective quilt that can be displayed at events or brought to rallies. Fiber artist Stevie Emmerich says there's a long history of quilts being used as a political tool.
This is a great example of how quilting can be like a form of history keeping and like documentation, and everyone's bringing in like pictures and names and words, and all of that is going to be stitched together.
But first, Darnisha is confronted with the same difficult question that faces everyone in this gallery. How do you encapsulate your son, your nephew, your partner, your friend in a fabric square the size of your hand?
He is like no other. He's very vibrant, and you can like tell when he walks into a room.
Yamadi Gonzalez is here making a square for her fiancé, AJ, who's at a low-security prison in Kewaunee, Illinois. She put her handprint on the fabric. Now, between the fingers, she uses brightly colored thread to stitch words like trust and loyalty.
Words have become very meaningful for us the past, like, 11 years. We can't, like, physically have much time together, so talking and communicating have been, like, the foundation of our relationship, so that's what I wanted to capture.
Nearby, AJ's mom, Carmen Aliquin, has decorated her square by spelling out her son's name in musical notes.
AJ would always be singing to all of us.
I'm sorry, I'm getting emotional. But AJ was loved and is still loved by many, many.
One of the organizers, Julie Anderson, with the advocacy group Restore Justice, says these meetups aren't just about the quilt.
One of the reasons we're doing it is because creating this together, I believe, builds community, and we are a community out here of loved ones. And also just to kind of show other people that those people inside have people outside who love them.
Across the room, Darnisha Lanier finishes the quilt square for her son. It's got his name and photo on it, a couple of colorful butterflies, and at the bottom, one big word, freedom.
He wants his freedom. He wants to be home.
And while Sharon and everyone else incarcerated in Illinois can't travel, the quilt can. Sharing a small part of who these people are beyond their convictions, square by square. Lauren Frost, WBEZ News.
Coming up, what happens when someone is transferred from a maximum security prison to a less restrictive environment? A new class at the Danville Correctional Center aims to help. We'll have that story in a moment. This is Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinois closed the century-old Stateville Correctional Center last year. Many of the men housed there went from being in a maximum security facility to less restrictive environments. And that transition can be overwhelming. Emily Hayes has more on what one facility is doing to help new transfers adjust to their surroundings.
There are parts of the medium-security Danville Correctional Center that don't look anything like the prisons you see in movies.
The sidewalks, and then there's grass in between, and they're kind of brick buildings on all the sides. And there's some flowers here, some daffodils, I guess.
This open green space could be a city plaza, but when you look a bit closer,
we have some wire that's kind of like barbed wire over stuff.
Danville had an infusion of new people following the closure of Stateville, including Alfred Moore Bay.
Doing time has, you know, it has a lot of pressure on you.
Moore Bay has been incarcerated for 27 years for abetting a murder. At first, prison officials brought him to another maximum security facility. Then he applied to move to Danville.
After you've been on the max level for so many years, where you're just in a cell on a thin gallery, every now and then you get a little movement, but here it's a lot more movement.
He says that can be hard to handle, especially when you spent years training to constantly be on high alert like he has. It's something corrections counselor Jason Baer noticed after the transfers began arriving.
Some of those guys are older, and the speed of the younger guys, it's almost an overstimulation, and they are very grumpy. They can be very grumpy about it.
Michael Abdul-Rauf Hearn understands these feelings. He's served 23 years so far for a murder charge. About a year and a half ago, he and others at Danville created a class to help the new influx from Stateville and other high-security prisons.
We've kind of piecemealed it.
Hearn looked at what the prison was already doing well, the peer education program called Building Block.
We've seen things that the building blocks have used, and we think those things were great and we adapted it.
Their new 3-month program includes units on critical thinking, communication, trauma, and life planning.
It may seem a little bit out of place for individuals in custody who are serving longer sentences or have been incarcerated for a longer amount of time than the average prisoner here within the institution, but we still feel it's important and we've integrated it into our curriculum.
Hearn met Alfred Morbay when he moved into the long-term offender section of the prison. That's when he found out that Morbay had already taken higher education courses on restorative justice at Stateville, so he asked him to help out. Morbay teaches 3 communication skills classes a week, plus weekends and tutoring.
A lot of people, when they're making that transition, you know, they seem to be standoffish, don't want to say much, hold back things, you know, I'm tough, macho, but to break that wall is big. And when you're able to break that wall, you can start to see the wall come down, and now people become more who they are.
Hearn says they're currently in their last module with what he calls the long-term guys, who are often sentenced for life.
We'll be on the yard, or we'll be in obscure places, whether the commissary or what have you, and I hear somebody repeating to another person something that they learned. Because then it means they've internalized it. It's just not regurgitating it, but they've used it in a way that is appropriate and in a way that cements that they've actually understood it.
Corrections counselor Jason Baer oversees the program from the staff side, but says Morbay, Hearn, and the others do the heavy lifting. And in a short amount of time, they've already helped the younger and the older men get to know one another.
Those guys are awesome. They're like, hey, you know, hey, go meet them. See how they got the pep in their step.
Peer education in Illinois prisons started at the Danville Correctional Center, and its programs have shown enough success that staff from other facilities are replicating their model throughout the state. In the process of teaching others, Alfred Morbay says he's also learned more about himself.
I didn't think I was an effective communicator. And going through the program, it showed me that actually I'm pretty good at it, and it's natural.
I'm Emily Hayes.
The assassination of Charlie Kirk sparked a debate about free speech in the U.S., especially on college campuses, where Kirk spent much of his time debating the issues. They are also where some professors were targeted by Kirk's organization for taking stances that Turning Point USA found objectionable. Central Illinois Republican Congressman Darren LaHood told Lauren Warnicki he supports a robust dialogue on politics and government.
Listen, I think Charlie Kirk encapsulated what it means to have engagement, to have substantive talk. Obviously, he was a conservative, a Republican, but I think Charlie didn't stand for violence. Charlie stood for engagement, having substantive conversation, having dialogue, having both sides have an argument, but to do that in a civil way. That's what he stood for. And he really, I think, with his enthusiasm and his optimism, he promoted that and encouraged young people to be engaged and be active. And I think we've seen that both on ISU's campus here. And I think after his tragic death and gruesome death, I think people are now mobilized to want to be engaged in the debate of politics. And I think you're going to continue to see that between now and into the future, and particularly next year's election.
There has been some counter discussion about some of Turning Point USA's tactics, particularly around the watch list of professors who were alleged to be espousing progressive or democratic views in the classroom or somehow suppressing conservative students. 3 professors at ISU have been on that list at one point. One said that they were fearful enough that ISU police got involved. So can you kind of circle that square for us in regard to your comments on Charlie's platform around really championing free speech?
Well, violence should never be part of a civil conversation related to politics and government and issues of the day. And we have a responsibility as elected officials. The media has a responsibility to tone down the rhetoric related to violence or any type of harm. Again, Charlie stood for engagement. And so no one should be advocating for anything related to violence. I'm not familiar with the watch list and how that works, but what Charlie Kirk and Turning Point has stood for in all of my interactions around them is for civil, substantive engagement on core issues. And I think that's what made Charlie so successful.
In the rescission bill, USAID money was rolled in with money for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That bill ultimately passed and yanked funding for both of those efforts. Now it looks like there is some enthusiasm for restoring some USAID money for what the administration has described as America First goals. How do you define that, and are you supportive of it?
Well, I think we have to be engaged in the world. Our soft power is important, and USAID played a key role in doing that. Now, not all of that money, I think, was being spent in the appropriate way, and so I think there had to be some rescissions there. However, what Secretary Rubio has said is there will be a reconstitution of some of those funds that will be focused on the foreign policy agenda of the United States. And so I think using that money to pursue the goals of the Trump administration and for America on supporting our allies around the globe, pushing back against the Communist Chinese Party, pushing back against Iran and some of our adversaries around the world, I think that in a more targeted, strategic way is good public policy.
HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has recently been putting out some information about changing the vaccine schedule potentially. Doctors have disagreed with this. They've also disagreed with President Trump's statements regarding caution around use of Tylenol for pregnant or expectant mothers, suggesting that acetaminophen Tylenol has a link, potential link to autism. What do you make of the dissonance between what doctors are saying and what the administration is saying?
Well, I have concern about disinformation and misinformation. I mean, I don't think we have enough evidence to reach some of the conclusions that have been reached. And so I'm cautious on some of the things that have come from the HHS secretary. And I think what I would tell people is rely on evidence and facts that are based on science have been proven to be successful.
That's Central Illinois Congressman Darren LaHood. He spoke with Lauren Warnegy. Interest in local food boomed during the COVID-19 pandemic, but food prices are top of mind for a lot of consumers right now, and locally grown fruits and vegetables tend to cost more than produce at grocery stores. As part of our Food Roots series from Harvest Public Media, Rachel Kramer explores why that is.
Thank you. At the Ames Main Street Farmers Market in central Iowa, Arlen Gorskowski opens several bags to show what he's purchased this morning.
My first bag, I got a lot of tomatoes and basil. I'll use that for like a fresh pasta. Then I got some carrots.
Gorskowski loves to cook and visit farmers markets around the state. He says he could buy a lot of this produce at grocery stores, but it's not the same as something locally grown and picked fresh.
I don't mind spending the extra money on it because it's better quality and I get what I want.
Gorskowski and others at the farmers market point out that local produce is not always more expensive. A lot of it depends on what's in season and where someone shops for groceries. But generally, prices are higher buying directly from a farmer in the Midwest or Great Plains than Walmart or another large grocery chain. But why is that?
So I think the first thing that comes to my mind is scale.
Courtney Lawn is the Food Systems Program Manager with Iowa State University Extension. She says large commercial farms can invest in equipment and technology to grow, harvest, wash, package, and distribute their product in bulk. So think about green beans. Larger operations may have machinery that can harvest multiple rows at once.
That helps with that efficiency side of the production.
In contrast, a small-scale farmer growing dozens of vegetables is likely hand-picking green beans, which takes a lot more time. Michelle Miller, a researcher at the University of Wisconsin, says scale also affects transportation costs.
The two main costs in moving food are fuel and labor. And when you've got, you know, a full truckload, you're optimizing both those two components in moving food from one place to another.
She says another challenge for local growers, especially in the upper Midwest, are cold winters.
Mexico can grow green beans all year round, whereas we can only grow them for the one or maybe two crops. in a year.
And then there are labor costs for picking and processing fruits and vegetables. Workers in many other countries often make less. Kevin Marshall is the owner-operator of Indigo Acres, a market garden farm north of Oklahoma City. They grow without chemicals and use regenerative farming practices. Because of that, labor makes up about 70% of Indigo Acres' expenses.
We're not really just hiring people to go pull weeds or run a tractor. We're hiring a skilled laborer that knows how to grow the plants, knows how to run the tools. We have specialized tools. There's a lot of training involved.
Marshall adds that he has to pay a little extra so employees don't quit when it's over 100 degrees out. Indigo Acres sells produce online and through the Oklahoma City Food Hub. Marshall says his prices are higher than Walmart's, but as he tries to explain to consumers, his produce is better.
It's a higher quality product. It's fresher. It hasn't been shipped across 1,000 miles or 2,000 miles or across the ocean, so it has a higher nutrient density.
The true cost of food is something Lon, the program manager at Iowa State University, hopes more consumers will consider. From her perspective, the driving question isn't necessarily, how do we make it cheaper?
Farmers provide this value of producing our food, and we should buy that food. Like, food costs money to produce, and so how do we figure out what we're our willingness to pay?
She says once someone understands why a cucumber grown locally costs more, they can decide whether it's worth it. I'm Rachel Kramer, Harvest Public Media.
A Southeast Iowa writer and now filmmaker believes pie is more than just a savory meal or delicious dessert. So much more, she made a documentary about it. Tri-State's Public Radio's Rich Egger reports.
The film is called Piowa, A Piece of America. Beth Howard, who lives on a farm near Donelson, directed the film. We spoke over the phone while she was in L.A. for the Silicon Beach Film Festival, where Piowa won the Audience Award for Best Feature Documentary.
That was really never my strategy to enter film festivals, but then I just went ahead and entered a few just to see what it was like, and then I won. I won Best Food Film at the San Antonio Film Festival in July, so I'm like, oh, well, maybe my film is better than I thought it was.
Beth, who also does commentaries on TSPR, had never made a film before. She says it's kind of like making a pie. The baker knows all the hard work and struggles that go into making it. Maybe there were a few missteps along the way. But when you serve it up, people love it.
Pie is not about perfection. That's what I preach. And, you know, I watched the film. I've seen it 200 some times, you know, and, you know, I still see shots where I go, oh, I wish I would have done something different there or used different footage.
But she says no one else notices that or cares. She says they leave the theater feeling uplifted and wanting to make pie. And that's what Beth was aiming for. She spent 2 years making the film, hoping to spread a message of kindness and generosity.
It doesn't take much to be kind. It could be just a slice of pie.
Beth has not found many people who don't like pie, and she's heard over and over again that church ladies make the best pies. Beth has written 4 books, 3 of which are about, you guessed it, pie. After completing the latest one, she wanted a new challenge. She had pitched a pie documentary series for quite a few years, but no one bit on the idea.
I just kept hearing, no, we want a baking competition, or we want a celebrity host. And it's like, no, it's neither of those things. So, part of the impetus of making this film was I wanted to make a proof of concept, and I wasn't going to let the gatekeepers stop me.
Now she's made a film that's resonating with people and winning awards. Beth, of course, is also a maker of pies. One of her favorites is chicken pot pie.
And I don't make it very often, and when I do, my partner Doug and I, we like polish off half of a giant pie in one sitting. And believe me, that's a lot of pie because it's a big pie. So I don't make it too often. I have no self-control when it comes to chicken pot pie.
Screenings of Piowa are scheduled into the middle of next year. A list of screenings can be found on Beth's website, theworldneedsmorepie.com. There are quite a few dates on the schedule. Beth says she was not expecting such a demand for the film, but it's a good problem to have. She believes the film's popularity is due to its positive message.
Yeah, no, I think people are just really hungry for something uplifting, comforting. The nostalgia, I think, strikes a big chord with people.
She says people come up to her after seeing the film, sometimes with tears in their eyes, and tell her it reminded them of their mother or grandmother. Beth says the film shows people being kind, and she says no act of kindness or generosity is too small to make the world a better place. Rich Egger reporting.
We'll get an update on the trucking industry just ahead on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. It's a tough time for the trucking industry. The so-called Great Freight Recession has been going on for 3 years. Trucking industry leaders gathered in Normal recently for their annual conference. That's where Illinois Trucking Association Executive Director Matthew Hart told Paul J. Aguilar that the industry is looking for ways to fortify their companies from the economic pressures.
Probably the biggest issue in the trucking industry today is just the overall economy. You know, in Illinois, we move over 70% of the freight. When it comes to manufactured freight, we move 95% of all the manufactured freight. And we're a huge manufacturing state, right? So anytime the economy is not doing well, we're not doing well. And right now, we're seeing some slowdowns in certain segments. We'd like to see the economy pick up in other places. We'd like to see manufacturing pick up a little bit more. And that's what we're, you know, we're talking about, how to really run your trucking company in a time where maybe your expenses are going up faster than your revenues are. But we're here to help folks do that.
So should companies or like truckers in Bloomington Normal be concerned?
When you run a trucking company, trucking in general is a high volume, low margin business, right? So our margins are very, very small, which means we have to run a lot of miles. We have to do a lot of loads to make the money it takes to put fuel in the truck, to pay the driver, to keep the lights on. And so you've got to be really, especially today in 2025, you've got to be really sharp and watching all of your expenses. You've got to be out there fighting for new revenue streams because we're all fighting to keep our companies afloat. We're fighting to keep our employees employed and keep food on the table for the families that rely on us for a job.
Are you aware of the possibility of a multimodal transfer center being built near the airport in this area?
Yeah, you know, this is a great area for transportation. Anywhere in the Midwest is a great area for transportation. We've got manufacturing, we've got highways, we've got rail, and all of those come together. You can't rely on one mode of transportation in 2025. A lot of the manufacturing in the Midwest relies on parts that come from not only Asia, but parts that come from Canada and Mexico. A lot of times those parts are getting here by rail, sometimes they're getting here by truck. But at the end of the day, we've got to have reliable inputs for those manufacturers to make what they make here in the Midwest.
Is there like a big fear that AI-powered trucks, things along those lines, are going to make those opportunities for people like harder to find?
AI is a big part of trucking, and we're figuring out ways to use AI to run better trucking companies. We're very early on in the stages of using AI in the trucking industry, but we also think AI can be a great place for us to run safer trucking companies out there, and that's what we're really excited about as well.
What about the Big Beautiful Bill do you think will be good for the trucking industry or negative?
Probably most important to our industry is the bonus depreciation is a big deal. When you buy very large, very expensive equipment and you depreciate it, there's advantages that we can capitalize on when we can use things like bonus depreciation. And the other big thing is the extension of the 2017 tax cuts. Those were set to expire, and a lot of our guys were looking at much higher tax bills going into 2026, and now they can be rest assured that their taxes are not going to go up in 2026. And that's a big deal, especially today when we're 3 years into a freight recession and we're looking for every penny that we can. And the last thing we need is higher taxes.
That's Matthew Hart, Executive Director of the Illinois Trucking Association. He says the industry is looking to attract more women truckers. He says studies show they tend to be safer drivers because they take fewer chances on the road. Chicago area divorce attorney Rayford Dalton Palmer is author of the Amazon bestseller, I Just Want This Done, and a similarly named podcast about dating and divorce. He spoke with Maureen McKinney about trends in marriage splits, including a growing number of what are called gray or senior divorces.
One of the topics you had mentioned you could speak to was gray divorce.
It's a significant issue, definitely these days demographically. and a trend in terms of divorce filings. And the folks that seek us out as clients, we see an increasing trend in our divorce firm. And we want to make sure we're addressing the concerns of those people who I think have traditionally been underserved and underinformed. The traditional divorce lawyer market or business is aiming at people 35 to 45 years old. There are a lot of people out there getting divorced in their late 50s and 60s and older who have somewhat different concerns and issues, and that isn't being addressed very well.
Why not?
It's somewhat new, and divorce lawyers aren't really paying much attention to that trend. People, I don't think, have catered to that group in terms of providing them with information and resources maybe more appropriate for their position in life. For example, division of assets, alimony, you know, the circumstances, situation changes when people are either already retired or close to retirement. The math is different from people that have, for example, young children, don't have a lot of retirement put away yet, et cetera.
Why do you think the numbers are on the upswing?
People are living long enough to and healthy long enough to see that maybe they want something else in their lives, that their relationship is no longer meeting their needs. And in the past, when people would die in their 60s, they weren't in a position where they thought a divorce was possible. They thought, well, I'll just stick with this because, frankly, it's not worth the expense and grief and effort. But now people are thinking, well, I might live to be 85 or older, and I'll be healthy longer. So people are looking inward, and they're deciding, maybe for this next chapter of my life, I need something different. And they think they have time and that it's okay to pay the expense necessary. They've made that cost-benefit analysis before. If your friends are all dying in their 60s, you figure, you know, why am I worrying about getting divorced at this point? And that is a radical change that's only occurred in the last few decades.
What is different for those who are in the senior years as opposed to more traditional divorce age?
They have concerns that are a little different. So usually we're not dealing with children. We have adult children. We have grandchildren that we're dealing with. We've got people concerned about now that either one or both people are retired. So the way that they're looking at asset division is very different. And concerns about alimony are different because of the way our law works. So for example, a reasonable retirement age for somebody in Illinois law is somewhere between 63, 64, and 67. I've done divorces where people are working, but they're older than that. So let's assume there's been a long-term marriage, 35, 40-year marriage, and somebody's working, making good income, and there's an order for maintenance, or what we call alimony in other states. Well, the person receiving that thinks, great, this person legally could retire tomorrow, and there's nothing I can do to stop it. So a maintenance award that might have looked good to somebody who's 35 or 40 years old looks pretty sketchy to somebody who's 75 years old and their husband or wife could retire at any moment, which changes the equation when you're looking at how to resolve a case.
What is the kind of advice you would give someone who is in a relationship that's ending and is near retirement?
So much depends on the circumstances. So there are a couple ways to look at it. If you're the person who might be paying maintenance and you can afford to retire, meaning you've got enough assets and you figure you don't need to work full time, then technically or theoretically it behooves you to retire before a divorce, because then it's a fait accompli and it's done and you won't be paying any maintenance if you're actually retired. I think people should, if they enjoy working, keep working. You know, there's a little too much emphasis, I think, sometimes on divorce planning, people tying themselves in knots in their lives to try to get an edge on their divorce when, let's assume you're paying support and it's something under a third of net income, which is how the formula works in Illinois. Wouldn't you rather make two thirds of your net income and have that money at your disposal to invest in stuff rather than not making any? So that's something I talk to people who are normally going to be paying maintenance. They'll say, well, I want to quit my job so I don't have to pay maintenance. Well, you're kind of cutting off your nose to spite your face. So it's so important about to decide what your priorities are. But if your plan was to retire anyway, then there's no reason to wait. That would be my suggestion on that issue. Because if you're not retired, that's the status quo from the court's perspective. And the lawyer on the other side, the lawyer for the soon-to-be ex, their perspective is, well, you're working, so you need to pay maintenance. Despite the fact the person says, I plan to retire next month or in 3 months or 6 months or a year, they'll say, fine, then do that then, and we'll discuss it at that point. If you're a person who is the person making less income, I would urge that person to get some type of job that has health insurance, because health insurance is expensive. And after you get divorced, there's no guarantee your spouse will stay working. They can retire at any time. And that means support might be terminated. Your maintenance gets terminated. And that's what was paying for your health insurance. And now you're burning through your retirement assets to pay for basic expenses. And that's not a good thing. So, because assume we're getting divorced at 65 or 60 to 75 years old, we've got a lot of life left to live and expenses to pay. So it's a quality of life issue. And you don't have to work very hard to get a job that pays for health insurance. There are part-time employment at major companies, part-time jobs, where they'll provide health insurance. And that's just gold these days. Either keep working to maintain your health insurance and have something to do. You don't have to kill yourself, but keep working and generate that income, because it doesn't reduce maintenance very much. And it provides a safety cushion in the event your soon-to-be ex retires, gets ill, gets let go. And there are a lot of things beyond that person's control. A court order that says they're supposed to pay maintenance is just a piece of paper.
What is the most common age or situation for people to split?
You have what you kind of call the starter marriages. These are people married between 3-5 years and things just don't work out. They might have a young child or they have no kids and they get divorced. There's the folks that are in the middle area we see probably the most of, and these are people who've been married 15, 20 years. They have a couple kids, usually a kid in high school and maybe in grade school, or somebody in college and somebody in high school. And they're in their 40s, something like that, somewhere between 35 and 50 years old. And then the third group are the I guess you'd say the gray divorce people, but that's a pretty wide range these days. I've seen people anywhere from, let's say, 60 in their 60s to in their 70s. And the usual hallmarks of that are the children are fully launched. Everybody has time to focus inward again. The nest is truly empty. And one of the two people says to themselves, is this all there is? And they see a lot of life left ahead of them. Now the kids are gone, they're grown, and they finally have come to the point where their cost-benefit analysis tips toward they're deciding that the divorce is worth the gamble.
Is there a scenario where it is more difficult to reach an agreement if people have similar incomes?
It tends to be more difficult if one person isn't working and they're looking to receive support. If they're close in incomes, it's a lot easier because there's no alimony and it's just a division of assets and debt situation. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's definitely less complex. If both people are working, they're less concerned about their own financial situations because they're paying the bills with their own incomes and they've got health insurance. So those cases tend to be easier. The trickier ones are ones where one person is not working, or maybe they have medical challenges and can't earn an income, or it's a very small income relative to the other party. Because I like that issue I raised before, where it's one thing if the person was going to work another 20 years, or spousal support court order that says they're going to pay you indefinitely, which is what, if you've been married over 20 years in Illinois, that's what the court orders, assuming the income is there. If somebody's looking at being supported for another 20 years, they're not concerned. But in a situation of a gray divorce where somebody's retired or unable to work or only able to earn a small income, they're very worried that even if they get that maintenance order, the person could die, get sick, get fired, or quit. And the court will allow them to quit it after they're 65-ish years old and they can terminate maintenance then. So that leaves them burning through assets. And a lot of folks You know, in our market, more people have, you know, substantial assets, but broadly, a lot of people in the baby boom generation have not saved, or they haven't saved what they really need for retirement. You know, any wealth manager will tell you that. And that leaves people in a precarious position, you know, relying on Medicare, Social Security, and things of that nature.
That's divorce attorney Rafer Dalton Palmer. He's author of the bestseller, I Just Want This Done, and a podcast with a similar name. He talked with Maureen McKinney about trends in marriage breakups, including a growing number of gray or senior divorces. We're out of time for Statewide this week. Thanks for being along with us. Join us next time. We'll return with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can always find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.